comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It is the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. Well, some big news today out of Vandenberg Air Force Base and DARPA. They successfully launched and flew the new HTV-2B. Now, you're reading headlines and stories that tell you it was not a success, that it was a failure. And I'm saying it was successfully launched, and they flew their new HTV-2B, the hypersonic aircraft. And they had publicly stated that this craft could fly at speeds of up to 13,000 miles per hour. Now, don't you find that just a little bit interesting? Do you know what the SR-71 is? Is it SR-71? Yeah, SR-72? 71, the Blackbird. That thing was at one time the fastest aircraft we had. Its top speed is still classified. It's retired, and its top speed is still classified. So here's a brand new toy, and they announced to the world, we're going to test it, and they announced to the world, it can fly up to 13,000 miles per hour. When the Blackbird that's retired is still classified. That's odd. I mean, that is just freaking odd. That's off the wall odd that they would come out and say in public that this thing can fly up to 13,000 miles per hour when they won't tell you how fast the Blackbird can fly. Well, to my bent, warped, and convoluted mind, that can only mean one thing. It's a lie. This thing can fly much faster than they publicly stated. It's got to be the case. Well, they said about 22 minutes to 26 minutes. There's different reports about that. Into the flight, they lost contact with it. Interestingly, they lost contact with it when it hit the 13,000 miles per hour. When it reached the top speed they had published, all of a sudden, they lost contact with it. That's pretty interesting, too. Do you think it might just be possible that the thing was pre-programmed to cut its public telemetry stream once it hit the maximum published speed? Do you think it might just be possible that the public telemetry shutdown was so that a private speed test with private telemetry could be conducted above the 13,000? I don't know. Just a thought. Just a thought. From a bent, warped mind, just a thought. Jerry Wills is out around the country. Be sure you check out jerrywills.com and be sure you click on events so you can see the next place, date, and time where you can go and meet Jerry personally. We'll be back right after this. All right. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And tonight's going to be, I think, a very interesting night for you. Some of you will go, oh, yeah. And some of you will go, that guy has lost his mind. Because what I am going to say here tonight, what I'm going to discuss, is destined to be highly controversial. All alternative views are considered to be controversial. But by whom? Now think about it. Who is it that considers a particular idea to be controversial? Well, it's the establishment within whatever field we are discussing. And it's the establishment that says, that's controversial. Well, is the establishment usually right? Well, history shows that they're almost never right. They are the people that brought you the flat earth. The earth is the center of the universe. No such things as germs. Man will never fly. There are no planets outside of this solar system. The list is endless. Alternative views, on the other hand, have a remarkable history of being correct. So what I am going to discuss here tonight, what I'm going to reveal to you tonight, is destined to rankle the established view. It is destined to put their panties in a knot. These, of course, are the people that brought you the flat earth. Now, we're all familiar with the Sumerians because of primarily the work of Zechariah Sitchin. Had it not been for Zechariah Sitchin, most of us would never have heard of the Sumerians. I will tell you, I heard of them quite a while before I heard of Zechariah Sitchin, but that's because I studied ancient history in college, and I was really into that. However, I will also tell you that there is very little that is said about the Sumerians in those ancient history courses and in those textbooks. They are mentioned, but very little is said about them, and yet they are one of, if not the, most significant civilizations ever. They date back to about 4,000 B.C. At least, let me rephrase that. We date them back to about 4,000 B.C. That's as far back as we're able to find the Sumerian civilization. But what about before 4,000 B.C.? Have you ever thought about that? These people didn't just materialize out of thin air and just boom, there they were in Mesopotamia with a civilization. They had a history before 4,000 B.C. What do we know about them? We do know a little, but not much. We know, because of their writings, that they claimed they came from the north. That's what they said. All right. Sumer is located in what today we call Iraq. For much of history, it has been called Mesopotamia, which means the land between the two rivers. The land between the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And that's where they were. They were in what is today Iraq. Now, if you head north out of Sumeria, or out of Sumer, and by the way, those of you who are particularly interested in and involved in Bible study, it's called the land of Shinar, S-H-I-N-A-R. That's the Hebrew word for Sumer. And you'll find it. It's mentioned in your Bible. When you head north out of Sumeria, the instant you cross out of Sumer, you have crossed into what today is Iran. Now, it came to be known as Scythia, S-C-Y-T-H-I-A. Down through history at some point, that region came to be known as Scythia, a name which the Romans picked up, adopted, and which they used as well. So the Sumerians, the people we call Sumerians, came from the region that is today Iran, and has been known through most of history as Scythia, just like the area where Sumer is through most of history has been known as Mesopotamia. And that plays a role in what I'm going to reveal to you here tonight. About 4000 BC, the Sumerians came from Scythia to Mesopotamia and set up shop, and basically they just brought civilization in a box. In most places, when the archaeologists go in and start digging, the first layers, the first levels that they come to in a civilization that's buried, they're coming to the first thing they come to is the end of that civilization. As they keep going deeper, they're going back in time, and they go through, we have the end, that was not good times, so the times are getting better, things are becoming a little more developed and a little more lush, a little more luxurious as we go back in time. Then we reach that golden age, and they keep digging, and they go back beyond that golden age, and things begin to dwindle back toward the beginning. In other words, at the beginning in most civilizations, things are primitive. Then they get better, 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 better. You reach the golden age. And then once you've reached the golden age, it's there for a little while, and then it begins to get worse, 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 and dwindles away. So if you drew a picture of it, it would be thin at both ends and wide in the middle. That's not what you have with the Sumerians. When you get to the Sumerians, you get to the earliest stages, the earliest known Sumerians being in Mesopotamia, and you're in the Golden Age immediately. Bang, it's there. They have schools, public schools. They have public libraries, laws, plumbing and sewage, government, science, religion, all from way back then in 4000 BC. So it's as if when they came from Scythia to the north and got to Mesopotamia, they just unpacked a civilization. Part of that is that they brought their belief that the Anunnaki were gods, and apparently the Anunnaki continued to interact with them at the earliest stages of Sumerian civilization. There is already this knowledge of and belief in the Anunnaki as gods. Anunnaki, some people say that means, and this is what Zechariah Sitchin said, that Anunnaki means those who from heaven came down. Well, it more accurately means the people of, or the tribe of, or the children of Anu. Now, there may have been this belief, and there was this belief among the Sumerians, that they came down from heaven. But that that K-I ending is the plural, so you have Anunnaki. So it could be the people of Anu who came down. Now, those who have seen my seminar, Gods in the Garden, know I deal with, in Hebrew language, when you make something plural, you put an I-M, kind of almost a Y-I-M ending on the end, and it's pronounced Yim. And so you have El, is God, Elohim, gods, plural. In Sumerian, the K-I on the end, the ki on the end, and more especially the I on the end, makes it plural. In a lot of languages today, that's the case. And in some languages, it's a double I on the end, makes it plural. There came a time when the Sumerian civilization did go into decline. We don't see a period of time where they're building up towards the Golden Age. It's just, boom, there's the Golden Age. But there was a time when they did go into decline. It seems the Anunnaki, their gods, had left them. And the question is, where did they go? Well, let's talk about the time when they began to go into decline. From 4000 BC all the way down to 2340 BC, you have pretty much a peaceful, stable civilization. And you have Sumerian kings. But then, in 2340, there is something unheard of. Something happened that was just unheard of. And that is a Sumerian in the city of Kish overthrows the Sumerian king of Nippur. So a civil war. And you want to guess what his name was? You've heard of him, surely. Sargon. He was Sumerian, and he overthrows the king of the Sumerians and established his own kingdom. And basically, he just said, okay, to the other king, you're fired, that's it. He had an uprising, there was a war, he overthrows him, and he sets himself up as king. And he calls his kingdom Akkad. Now, it's still in the same general area as Sumer, but much bigger. And he begins to expand. In 2320, he conquers all of Sumer. And what's pretty interesting is that's in 2320 BC. 2320. In 2230, that dynasty ends. And some nomads come in, the Gutians, and overrun the Akkadians and Sumer. But then, Sumer, you still got Sumerians there, and you've still got this strong belief in the Sumerian gods, and apparently still some interaction with these Anunnaki. And so they crawl out from under this bunch of nomads and reestablish Sumer. And that happens in 2150. However, 2150. 20 years later, 2130, Sumer has totally regained its independence. But by 2000 BC, the Hittites, whom all the experts said did not exist, I want you to keep that in mind as well. All the experts said, you know, the Bible talks about Hittites, and the experts said, there's no record of them anywhere. We've never heard of them. Nobody's ever heard of Hittites. Nobody ever met a Hittite. It's all fiction. Well, now they've found the Hittite Empire. And let me tell you, it was huge. The palace floor is 25 acres. Just the palace floor, the foundation, 25 acres. Anyway, we go now into a period of time from 2130 BC, I'm sorry, from 2000 BC, we go into a period of time where one group after another is coming in and conquering this area. And we get down to 1753. And there is a group of people called the Amorites, and they have a king that's very, very famous. You've heard of him, Hammurabi. And he conquers all of Sumer. And his kingdom lasts up till 1600 B.C. And then the Kassites conquer most of Mesopotamia. And here we go again. The Kassites are conquering Mesopotamia, and they defeat the Babylonians. And then by 1593, the Hittites are back, and they sack Babylon, and it's just upheaval. During that period of time, from then down to about 1490, or up to about 1490 B.C., that general period of time, Sumer, pretty much vanishes. And so do the Anunnaki. Did you ever wonder where they went? It is assumed by a lot of people that the Anunnaki got on their spaceships and went back to Nibiru, and maybe some of them did. But there is an amazing story, ladies and gentlemen, a story of another people at that period of time arriving in another place on Earth, arriving by air. It is an absolutely astounding story when you dig into it and find out there are possible links back to Sumer and definite links back to Scythia. It's a story about a people you may have heard of. There's a rock group named after them, and so you may have heard of them. It's a story of a people in a place that there has been such a complete shellacking put on the ancient stories of this place. A complete shellacking by the establishment. So that almost any ancient story from that place gets laughed off as though it's cartoonish. What's interesting, though, is when you dig into what little facts there are links back to Scythia, possibly through Sumer. We'll be back right after this.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, like no other talk radio on earth.
And we are back. Welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. And we're talking tonight about this mysterious thing, this mysterious people that show up suddenly in another part of the world from what we've been talking about, right at the time when all that turmoil hits and Sumer is just shortly finished. These people are said to have arrived at the new location by air, and we'll get into that. But who am I talking about? Well, you've probably heard of the group called Tuatha De Danann. A pretty popular group out there. They've got a lot of music out. Good group. They got their name from these people. And if you go and study what information there is for the Tuatha De Danann, and I know I'm not pronouncing that right, to my friends in Ireland, Perhaps one of you later can call and give us the correct pronunciation of that. Not only do I not speak Irish, I don't speak English, I speak American, and that's the best I can do with it, but it looks like Tuatha De Danann to me. These people, if you go digging into what information is available, you're going to discover something pretty interesting. Right off the bat, right in the beginning, they tell you they are mythological. None of the establishment scholars, none of establishment academia, place any, not even a microscopic possibility that these people actually existed. And yet, there are some of their fortifications still left, parts of them. There is a monolithic stone, a big stone, that is in Ireland today. That's where this happened. And that is, the Irish people will tell you, that's where the De Danann kings, the first kings of the De Danann, the great kings, were crowned, was at this stone. So there's evidence, physical evidence, that they actually existed. But right off the bat, I mean, just like that, when you start digging into this, you're going to find that the bilgewater from academia says they are mythological. And one guy has written that there's not a shred of evidence that there's any truth at all about their existence. Well, let's see. First of all, Tuatha De Danann is the old Irish name for these people. There's nothing that tells us what these people called themselves. If we go to Sumeria and we look at the gods in Sumeria, in their language, they called them Anunnaki. Every language calls it something different. Now, try to get that into your head, that every language is going to use different words for the same thing. I'm sitting in the United States of America. That's what we call it. If you go to Mexico City, they don't call it that. They call it Estados Unidos. It's the same place. So Tuatha De Danann is what the ancient Irish people called these people who showed up. And let me read you the description of what it was like when they showed up. They landed with horror, with lofty deed, in their cloud of mighty combat specters, upon a mountain of, I can't pronounce it, but it's Conmainchni of Connacht. On top of the mountain, they landed. Now listen to the description again. With lofty deed in their cloud of mighty combat specters. That's the way it was described in ancient Irish. This is the translation of that. They landed on top of that mountain with their cloud, in their cloud of mighty combat specters. On top of the mountain. They didn't come by ocean. They didn't land on a beach. They landed on top of the mountain. And what did they land? A cloud of mighty combat specters. So these ancient Irish people saw this mountain basically being inundated, invaded by a cloud of flying vehicles that landed there. And it says, without distinction to discerning Ireland, in other words, it made no difference to them what was going on Ireland. Without ships, a ruthless course, the truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth. That's in ancient Irish writings. And that's the description of the arrival of the Tuatha De Danann. Now, let me just say, I'm not through with this article. It is right now 13 pages long. It will probably be around 20 pages long, and I'll be finished with it before the weekend, and I will post it in our members area for you to download, and this, I think, will be very interesting to you. That's part of what's in that article. All right, let's do a little digging on this name, Tuatha De Danann. And then I'll get to why I say there is a connection right straight back to Sumeria, Scythia. Tuatha De Danann, that's the ancient Irish. And it basically means peoples of the goddess Danu, D-A-N-U. Really? Well, I have some other sources on this, but I'm going to use what you can find quickly. Okay? This is straight from the Wikipedia. This is from Wikipedia. Just type in Tuatha De Danann, and you, those of you who are watching, you can see it on your screen so you know how to spell it. And you'll see, do a search for Tuatha De Danann, you will see a Wikipedia article. Click that, and you will find what I'm about to read right now. How accurate is this translation of the name Tuatha De Danann? Well, the translation of Tuatha De Danann has been said to be peoples of the goddess Danu. And according to the Wikipedia article and others that I read, but this one you can find for yourself, it says, the translation of Tuatha De Danann as peoples of the goddess Danu is necessarily imprecise. Old Irish Tuath, plural Tuatha, means people, tribe, or nation. De is the genitive case of Dia, which can be god, goddess, supernatural being, or object of worship. They are often referred to simply as the Tuatha De, a phrase also used to refer to the Israelites in early Irish Christian texts. Danann is also a genitive for which the nominative case is not attested. It has been reconstructed as Danu, which by analogy with Anu is taken to be a female name. So they're telling you right here, it's all assumption. They're assuming that this is a female name. Now here is why they assume it's a female name, Anu. The name of the river Danube is believed to be Celtic or Celtic in origin. And Celtic river deities are usually female. Hindu mythology has a goddess called Danu, who may be an Indo-European parallel. However, this reconstruction is not universally accepted. It is also written Donan and Domnan. It goes on. All right, here's the point. This article, and there are references here, there are footnotes and references at Wikipedia, and you can click on those and run those references, and you can see the arguments for this, for that. And the Wikipedia article accurately states that this translation is imprecise. Tuatha does mean the people of. De instantly puts you into the framework of something supernatural. But what about Danu? In almost every language except English, the D by itself or with an apostrophe means from or of. Now, I used Spanish earlier. I'm going to use it again. This, what I'm going to say is an example that will hold true in many, many languages on the planet. You have to remember, and this is important, okay? This is very important. You have to remember that these records, these ancient Irish records, are written long after the arrival of Tuatha De Danann. They are written at a time when Rome has already held sway. Latin has been the universal language. Now we're into very early Christian times in Ireland, and the official language of the church is what? Latin. Therefore, when we see Danu, we really are looking not at Danu, but Danu. In Spanish, yo soy Kevin Smith de Estados Unidos. I am Kevin Smith from the United States. De means from or of. Yo soy, I am Kevin Smith, de means of, Estados Unidos, United States. Here we have Tuatha De, which means gods, people of gods, De Anu, of Anu. These are the children of Anu. Tuatha, the children or the people, De, gods, De Anu, children of the gods of Anu. I warned you right at the beginning of this show, there's no excuse for you to be sitting there fuming or for your jaw to be on the ground. I warned you it was going to be controversial, and I'm not through yet. Hang on to your hat, strap your socks to your legs. I'm going to blow all that off. We'll be back right after this. And before we get into this next bit of information, everyone listening right now, you need to go find you some masking tape or some duct tape, maybe some scotch tape, cellophane tape. And what you need to do is roll your pants legs up and secure the top of your socks to your legs here, because otherwise they are probably going to be blown right off. I told you this was going to be controversial, and I am proposing this as a possibility, but it's a very strong possibility. In my mind, a probability. I understand that the scholars are going to poo-poo all of this because they didn't think of it. I mean, they're digging around over there talking about it's, you know, the name of the river Danube is supposed to be of Celtic origin. The Celts did not even arrive in Ireland until 1,000 years after the Tuatha De Danann. Go figure. And then, there's a Hindu goddess called Danu. Oh, really? Okay. And that's supposed to have some significance in Ireland. Now, they're going to be upset, the scholars. It's going to put knots in their panties because they didn't come up with this, they didn't think about it, and they're going to do everything they can to rip this apart. Plus, internet geniuses, you know, people that are mushrooms everywhere else in the world, but they're absolute freaking geniuses once they get at the keyboard and get on the internet. They're going to rip this up. That's okay. The facts are the facts, and the facts are still there to be dealt with. And I'm going to present some more of the facts to you here. And let me say to the scholars in academia who already have knots in your panties, you might need to go change your panties because this is going to get rough on you. All right. The Tuatha De Danann, we've already dealt with what the name means. I want to hammer that home a little bit. Tuatha De Danann means the people are children of Danu. However, it is absolutely admitted that the D-E in this Tuatha De Danann, the D-E means either God, or it can be goddess, or it can be a place of worship, or it can be an object of worship. Okay, so they're identified as people who are either gods or the objects of worship. De Danu, or De Anu, okay? Tuatha De Anu. In Old Irish, the reason that has the name Tuatha De Danann instead of Danu is because that's plural. But Danu would be the proper name for this deity that they are said to be the children of, according to Old Irish. However, that's not quite true. According to modern translations of Old Irish, that's the case. Because they're in Ireland, right? They're separated from Sumeria, from Sumer, by a couple of thousand miles or more. Why would we find Anu in Ireland? Why would Anu not be in Sumer, but in Ireland? So they didn't even consider, and maybe, there had not been enough discoveries about the Sumerians at the time for them to even be familiar with Anu. And so they assume that this is Danu, and they assume that this is a female goddess. Rome, having been all over that area, had left its mark upon the languages. Now Christianity, now at the time when these accounts get written down, Christianity is sort of in full swing now in Ireland. It's in the early stages, but it's really beginning to get a foothold, and they're beginning to publish the histories of Ireland. And it's the church that's doing it. It's church writers that are doing this. And the language of the church, the official language of the church, is Latin. And so to say, children, actually, Tuatha De Danann, I think should be translated, the people or descendants or the children, gods of Anu. And the reason I think it should be translated that way is because what I think that's saying is these are the children of Anu, and they are gods. Now, I read to you the very amazing account of the landing, the arrival of the Tuatha De Danann in this ancient Irish account. This ancient Irish account is called the Libor Gabala Erin, which means the account of the invasions and conquering of Ireland. And it says, they landed with horror, with lofty deed. In other words, they didn't hide anything. They came in and it was obvious to everybody. Their cloud of mighty combat specters upon a mountain of, oh my God, Conmainchni Connacht. They are describing the arrival of the Tuatha De Danann by air in many awesome-looking combat vehicles, combat specters on top of the mountain. And it says, the truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth. Now, why? Well, first of all, these native people of Ireland, or at least the people who are already resident there, they're called the Firbolg, F-I-R-B-O-L-G. And the Firbolg couldn't fly. There was nothing in their experience, nothing in their background that would suggest to them flying vehicles. And yet, when the people got out of these flying vehicles, they looked human. Interestingly, though, they are described as fair-skinned, tall, fair-skinned, blonde hair or red hair, blue or green eyes. Now, those that are watching our TV channel can see a picture. This is a modern version, a modern artist conception of one of the Tuatha De Danann. Based on descriptions that are written in ancient Old Irish, we see a headdress that has horns on it. Now, when we see this here in the United States, being as we are fairly ignorant of most other people's histories, in fact, we're pretty ignorant of our own history, we think those must be Vikings. This is long before the Vikings. We'll be back. Get you some new socks. Welcome back. We're talking about the Anunnaki. Where did they go? And a possible link between the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann. Now, I told you, I've warned you, so I don't want anybody sending me a bill for new socks. Are you ready for this? Okay, remember as we went to break, I was telling you about this headdress that they wore, these gods, these Tuatha De Danann, which were viewed by the Firbolg as they were gods. In fact, they were in two classes, exactly like the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki had two classes. You had the gods, and then you had the sort of sub-gods under them, and they were the ones that did the menial labor, and they were the ones who complained to the gods, the immortals, if you will, or at least that's the way a lot of people refer to them. So they complained to the real upper-level gods, and as a result, the Anunnaki did genetic engineering and came up with basically us. Okay, that's the story for the Anunnaki. Well, the Tuatha De Danann, the Firbolg, had no contact with Sumer. They had nothing to do with Sumer. So they didn't get this idea from the Sumerians. They noticed that the Tuatha De Danann were in two classes. You had the gods, and then you had Tuatha De Danann that were not gods. And they were the craftsmen. They were the people who went out, and they were the herdsmen and the farmers, and they went out and did the menial work. And then you had this upper level that were gods. And those gods wore headdresses. The headdresses had horns on them. Interestingly, that's exactly what you had with the Anunnaki. With the Anunnaki, the upper level, the upper echelon, the gods, wore headdresses that had horns on them. And we can see it in the Sumerian tablets, and the clay, the impressions in clay from those seals that they rolled out. You can see that the Anunnaki are wearing headdresses with horns on them. And the Tuatha De Danann, that upper level, they also wore headdresses that had these horns on them. Okay, now let's go take a look at something that is a little bit more, that's a little bit stronger tie, a lot stronger tie. Remember I talked about both Sumer and Scythia. Well, Sumer, if you leave from Sumer headed north, you go right out into Scythia. And the Sumerians said they had come from the north. All right, so is there anything at all that ties the Tuatha De Danann to either Sumer or to Scythia? Well, I'm glad you asked, because as a matter of fact, there is. In that same Wikipedia article, now again, you can look at, you can follow the references, and you'll find this in the original books that it came from. But I'm referencing the Wikipedia article because I want you to be able to find this material quickly, and you can find it yourself online. There is, in that same Wikipedia article, there is the genealogy of the ruling family of the Tuatha De Danann. Whenever the Tuatha De Danann landed, they landed. I read you the description. They came in the air in their fearful or horrible or scary, what was the word that was used? Anyway, they're combat specters, and landed on top of that mountain. And it wasn't two or three. It was a cloud of these things, an armada of these things, landed on that mountain. Whenever the Firbolg, that's the name of the people who already live there in Ireland, when the Firbolg decided, well, we've got to do something. I mean, you know, all these people have landed, and, you know, what's up here? Well, the king of the Firbolg had a council, and his council met with him, and they decided what they needed to do was send out their best warrior to make contact and just to speak with them and find out what their intentions were. And so they sent a warrior by the name of Sreng out, S-R-E-N-G, and Sreng put on his armor and had his shield and his sword, and he's making his way out to where the Tuatha De Danann have begun to disperse off of the mountain, and they've begun to set up operations there. As he's making his way there, the Tuatha De Danann had already set up watchers to see if anybody's approaching. And so word came to them that this guy is approaching, and they sent out their guy by the name of Bres, B-R-E-S. So he goes out there, and the two guys approach each other. They stand there and look at each other for a while. Then they walked up close enough, and Bres has his shield and his spear and his all his armor. And the two guys get close enough to talk, but not to strike each other. And then they strike their shields into the ground, meaning, I don't intend to fight you. So they strike their shields into the ground, and then they begin to talk. And Bres is the one who speaks first. He's the Tuatha De Danann. And he speaks in the language that Sring understands, and Sring relaxes a little bit because he's hearing a familiar language. The two guys stand there and talk about their families and where they're from, and then it comes around to what do the Tuatha De Danann want. And what Bres tells him is, we want half of this island. And so if you'll withdraw to the other half, no problem, we'll live in peace. Other than that, there will be war. So the two guys exchange their armor. They exchange their weapons, not their armor, but their weapons, as a token of friendship. And they decide that no matter what happens between their peoples, these two guys would remain friends. And they go back, and Sring tells his people, the Firbolg, these people want us to give them half of the island, and I think we should do it. And Bres tells the Tuatha De Danann, I think you better prepare for war. And these are fierce warriors. They sent a mighty man out to meet me, and he was well armed. Well, the Firbolg hold council, and as you would expect, the king says, I'm not giving up half of my kingdom. So they have a war. And in this war, the Firbolg are decisively defeated, and the king of the Firbolg is killed. And he is killed by one of the goddesses of the Tuatha De Danann. Her name is Morrigan. Now you would expect, in those ancient times, the Firbolg would expect that they would become slaves of the Tuatha De Danann. That isn't what happened. Tuatha De Danann told them, you could have had half the island, but you wanted to fight. We're going to give you one quarter of the island. Choose which quarter of the island you want. And so the Firbolg chose five counties, one quarter of the island, and retreated to there and lived in peace. And the Tuatha De Danann did not enslave them, and they left them alone. There is nobility about that that's not customary in the ancient world. But there is also a genealogy. That genealogy is published in the Libor Gabala Erin. And that genealogy is also in that Wikipedia article. And it is amazing. It's amazing for a couple of reasons. First of all, at the time when that story that I just told you took place, Morrigan, if you look at the bottom tier of the genealogy, Morrigan is listed, as well as the other two goddesses that are mentioned in that story. I only mentioned one. By the way, that story, before they went to battle, let me tell you this, they had weather control. Before they went to battle, the Tuatha De Danann goddesses, there are three of them, caused clouds and rain for 3 days to come upon the Firbolg. And they caused it to rain red. Ever heard of that? Remember the red rain that just took place a few years ago over in Kerala, India? And we've done some shows on that. Remember that? The Firbolg experienced it, because these three goddesses controlled the weather and caused red rain on the Firbolg, and in addition to that, made it so they could not speak to each other for 3 days. As a warning to them, you don't want to fight us. You don't want to do this. But the Firbolg decided to fight anyway. Well, Morrigan was one of those goddesses. She's in the bottom tier there of the genealogy, but so is another name. In that bottom level, the last level of the genealogy, is Anu. A-N-U. Now you might say, well, that's sort of weak. That's not much of a link. Well, these would be the great-granddaughters of Nuada. It's misspelled if you're watching on television. It's spelled up there, Nudada. It's Nuada. He was the king of the Tuatha De Danann at the time when they landed on top of that mountain. He was the king when they got off of those flying machines, when they got off of those ships, airships, on top of that mountain. He was their king. His great-granddaughters are those goddesses. If you start with Nuada and count back, you count back 12 generations, and then the 13th generation is Agnoman of Scythia. Agnoman of Scythia, the same place the Sumerians said they came from. I told you there were links. I told you this would rock your socks. Was I wrong? I don't think so. I bet some of you right now are saying, oh my, man, that's fantastic. I've never heard this before. That's because you have an open mind. There are others who are saying, that's rubbish. I've never heard anything like that. Okay. That's because you have a closed mind. Whether we have ever heard of something before or not has no bearing on whether it's real. It makes absolutely no difference. There are places in this universe you've never heard of. It doesn't mean they don't exist. All right? So, the genealogy, the actual genealogy of the Tuatha De Danann, go right straight back through Sumeria, Scythia area, certainly to Scythia. Agnoman of Scythia. Now, those who are watching, you cannot read what's on your screen. It's way too small. So go to the Wikipedia article and see it for yourself, okay? Just, again, do a search for Tuatha De Danann. You'll come up with a Wikipedia link to an article about that. Click that and you'll see this information there. That genealogy is there and you'll be able to read it. And you'll be able to notice that as you head back up this line, the genealogy is not just of the family of Nuada. It's of the family of Agnoman of Scythia. And so it splits off, and you have on the right side of that genealogy some descendants who begin to have some Irish-sounding names. You don't have that on the left side. These are the purebloods. These are the ruling family. They're not intermixing with the locals. And their names have decidedly Sumerian-sounding names. Their names sound like they came from somewhere other than Ireland, and they sound similar to what you find in the area around Sumer. For instance, Nuada. Now, that does not sound in any way Irish, not even in Old Irish. So here we've got both the genealogy that takes them back to Scythia. We have the fact that they flew in and landed on top of the mountain. The fact that they controlled the weather in an attempt to show the Fearbulg, you don't want to fight us, you're not going to win. We have all of that. We have the Tuatha De Danann separated in two groups. We have the ruling class that are considered gods, and they wear the horns, the headdress with the horns. We have the lower class that are still Tuatha De Danann, but they are the craftsmen and the herdsmen and the farmers, etc. And we've got the fact that the name Tuatha means in Old Irish people, de gods, people, gods, de Anu, of Anu. And the genealogy takes us back to Scythia, from whence came the Sumerians talking about the Anunnaki with the exact same description. And these guys show up in Ireland. They fly in, a great armada of them, land on top of a mountain, scare the bejesus out of the Fearbulg. Let me read that description again. But they did this in the period of time at which Sumeria collapses. The Anunnaki have left the building in Sumeria, and Sumeria is gone. At that point, it just falls apart and it's out of history. But at the same time that happens in Sumeria, people with the exact description show up on top of a mountain, fly in and land on top of a mountain in Ireland. They landed with horror, with lofty deed, in their cloud of mighty combat specters, upon a mountain of, and I can't pronounce it, without distinction to discerning Ireland, without ships, a ruthless course. The truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth. They were already doing things we can't do. They were doing things we've never seen done. But when they got off of those ships, they looked like people. So we don't know if they are of heaven or of earth. That was the initial reaction of the Fearbulg. So what I think we're looking at, quite possibly, and as I said in my mind, quite probably, is we're looking at the migration of the children of Anu out of the land of Sumer across Europe to the island we call Ireland. And they did it in the 15th century B.C. That's when the Tuatha De Danann landed on top of that mountain in Ireland. All right, scholars have probably run out of panties. The rest of you have run out of socks. I want to give you the opportunity now to participate in tonight's show if you've got any question or comment. The telephone number is 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. If you happen to be outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can participate in the show by calling us or by sending me a flash message. To send a flash message, you simply go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show. Right above that picture is a link that says Flash Message, and you can use that to participate in the show as well. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Hey, Rusty.
Hi, Kevin. One thing that I can't reconcile with all this is if the Anunnaki and the other name that I cannot pronounce were this powerful, why would they have had to leave the other civilizations, and how could they have been conquered if they had this much more power?
Well, the answer to that, that's an excellent question. The answer to that is found in the old Irish writings. First of all, the Sumerians were the servants of the Anunnaki, and they became fat and lazy, and they were losing their grip on civilization. Okay, so it was eroding out from under the Anunnaki. All right. Now, and that's even if you don't have the, that's not from the ancient Irish writings. That's just from what we know about the Sumerians. Okay, now, the ancient Irish writings, the old Irish writings, tell us about the end of the Tuatha De Danann. And they say that the Tuatha De Danann had a great fear of iron. There was something about iron that was, they were allergic to it. And so whenever an invading force showed up, clad in iron and using iron weapons, the Tuatha De Danann retreated to the caves. And so the answer to the question of where might the Anunnaki be, it is legend, and it may be fact, I don't know, that the Tuatha De Danann still live in Ireland, in the caves, and the stories are that these caves go deep underground and even under the channel and back into Europe. Now, is that true? I don't know. But that's the ancient legend about what happened with Tuatha De Danann, is there are people that showed up with iron, and they were not, they didn't like iron for some reason. So there may be something about their DNA, something about their chemistry, something, I don't know. But that's the story.
Yeah, it just seems with all their technological, if they were that much more powerful.
Hang on, we have a break taking over, and we'll come right back to you. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this.
Are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we have Rusty from Michigan online. Rusty, let me ask you a question. Who is it that said that the Anunnaki are were gods?
I would say it probably started with the Sumerians.
Yeah, it was humans. Humans that said, oh, yeah, these are gods. Who is it that had the opinion that the Anunnaki had overwhelming technology? Humans. Okay. Now, if you take, you know what a stun gun is?
Yes.
Okay, not a taser that fires a projectile, but a stun gun. You know, it's got two little points on the end of it, and you stick it up against somebody and push the button, and it fires the electricity into them, but it has to be touching them.
Right.
Okay, a stun gun. You take a stun gun and go into a primitive area, and by primitive, I mean technologically primitive. Go to some uncontacted tribe in the Amazon. And if you can get through there without getting blowguns and darts in you, and you get to their camp, you try to talk to them, and they get a little bit antsy, and you reach over to the chief and touch him with a stun gun and zap him. He falls to the ground. You control that tribe right then. You have godlike power. Nevertheless, a dart from a blowgun into your neck will kill you. But right at that moment, you have shock and awe. And right at that moment, you're a god. That's the way this works. So the idea that if they were gods, and how did they, you know, why did they have to leave Sumeria? Why did they have to go to, you know, possibly to Ireland? And how did they meet their demise if they're gods? They're not gods. These guys that fly spaceships and come to Earth are not gods. They're just not. And right. they can die just like we can die.
Wouldn't they have weapons? The ship itself, wouldn't it have weapons? You know, kind of, we have missiles, but I imagine if they can transverse the stars, they'd have some type of weapon that could do, well, if they could control the weather, certainly they could control, I mean, it.
Not necessarily. Let me tell you something. The Russians went to Afghanistan and tried what we're trying. And they were defeated by people, basically, that were throwing rocks. We're not doing a real hot job either. I mean, our troops, don't take this the wrong way, troops. I think you're doing a phenomenal job at what you've been told to do. However, it's an ill-conceived plan if you think you're ever going to rule the Afghans, ever. Nobody in history has done it, not even the Romans. And eventually, I mean, you know, you can cap it off for a while, but eventually, they throw off whatever rule is on them. Now, we have some fantastic weapons. We really do. We've got some weapons. The United States does, and NATO does, weapons that are just phenomenal. But some of those really advanced weapons can be brought down with an AK-47. Some of them can be brought down by a sandstorm. So, you know, the idea that technology somehow makes people superior is just not true.
Well, you know, but it stems from that point, you know, we put that term gods to them, so we give them powers that seem like they have power that never ends, and that's not true, you know.
Well, who is it that wrote the definition for what a god is?
I would say a human.
Humans have created God in their own image.
Right, I agree with that.
Okay, so, and I'm not saying that there's no such thing as a real God. I'm saying whatever your notion is about what God is, some human somewhere came up with that, and you read it or you were taught it. You know, that applies to these ancient so-called gods as well. There's no indication, as far as I know, that they had any godlike powers. They had cool technology, but godlike powers. I haven't seen any evidence of that.
So, do you think those who Anunnaki or those who were in Ireland are controlling our weather now?
Controlling weather now. I don't know.
Yeah,
they might be.
Because back then they controlled it, it said.
Yeah. I don't know. They may have some influence on it. if these legends are true, and this is a huge if, you know, this is a huge if, but if these legends are true, they retreated underground, and they took their civilization underground with them. And they sound very much like the sort of people that Admiral Byrd said he met.
Yeah, it does. I don't know. You know, it's how do you get from speculation to real evidence?
Well, when you're dealing with things in this genre, even real evidence is not considered by the establishment to be real evidence. For instance, with UFOs, when you have a U.S. Air Force chief of staff, a general who is the boss of the Air Force, that says, UFOs, yeah, we had battles with them twice in Vietnam, and the press won't report it, and there's still some kind of debate out there as to whether they're real or not. I mean, what you're doing is dealing with information that people that basically are not playing with a full deck have decided is not evidence. Okay? So, I mean, it's pretty obvious that the mass media doesn't play with a full deck. Pretty obvious that the mass of population around the world is not playing with a full deck. And how can you get beyond, you know, and get this kind of thing verified? Well, you would have to get some establishment archaeologists and that would have to break ranks and would have to say, well, this information is compelling. Let's try and prove it or disprove it. Let's go and search. And they would have to really get into the information. Now, do you really think they're going to do that when you know what that's going to do is lead them right into Zachariah Sitchin's kitchen?
Right.
They're not going to do it.
No. Well, it's possible then, from what you're describing, that they may not have enough technology to fix the problems that we have created.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think anybody that's saying the extraterrestrials are going to rescue us, they need to go smoke some more weed.
Well, and it's not the fact that they don't want to rescue us or whatever, but it may be the fact that they don't have the technology in order to do it anyway.
It's quite possible. Now, they may have the technology to, you know, disrupt things that are electronic, for instance, nuclear missile sites. You know, we had Robert Hastings on talking about that. But you know something? If we ever, when I say we, I don't mean the United States. I just mean we, the human race. If we ever launch into a nuclear war, we erupt into that before they can get everything shut down, there's no possibility they can unexplode a nuclear bomb.
Right.
Okay, they are not gods.
So, one more question. That makes me wonder if it's possible if this God idea existed before they came.
Well, I don't know. Do you know how many people there would be if a Independence Day-sized craft hovered over their city and all of a sudden there were some beings that beamed down and didn't pull off a destruction of Earth, but just beamed down and wanted to speak with whoever's the leader of the city? Do you know how many people there would be that would be bowing down? You know, we humans, we're pretty dumb, and we're too willing to ascribe godlike powers to somebody just because, one, they're super rich, or two, they're super advanced with their technology, you know, and we just ascribe godlike powers to them.
Yeah,
we even do that to rock groups.
That's a fact.
Yeah, we're not too smart.
No, that's all I have, Kevin.
All right, thanks for the call. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
My name is Colin. I'm calling from New York.
Okay, Colin. What's on your mind?
Not much. I've been listening to the show tonight, and it's something that comes to my mind is that all the programs that are out there that seem ultimately harmful to human beings, I always wonder that how can there be a human being at the helm of such programs? Because, you know, why would the human beings put fluoride in water, for instance? Or, you know, why would we, you know, at this point it seems like orchestrated collapses of economy when we look at the bailouts that were availed and then what wasn't availed to the regular person.
Well, there's a simple answer to why humans would do that to other humans. The reason humans would do that to other humans can be wrapped up in one word: evil.
And maybe less than evil, just not being enlightened.
I don't think so. I think it's evil.
At this point, it seems like there's so much evil, but I can't even believe that, because at a certain point, aren't you just like killing yourself if you're doing all this stuff?
Yes, and that's a component of evil. It doesn't matter what it does to me as long as I win over you.
Yeah,
I don't care what it costs me.
I just heard this show about John Wayne Gacy comes to mind, and that idea, that, like what you just expressed, like that, you know, he even wanted to get away from his own evil, but it just has to ultimately express itself to the end or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all right. I understand that. But I just don't understand that. It seems to me that all right. This is shocking or whatever. But Ireland is full of war and mysticism and all of these sort of legendary stories.
Yeah. Hang on. We have a break, and I'll get back to you right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we shall return. Don't go away. Welcome back. We have Colin on the line. Colin, you were saying that Ireland is full of lore, but listen, so is every other country. Let me tell you what lore is.
That's true, too.
Here's how it gets to be lore, all right, instead of history. When you make when ancient people make a claim that there was an armada, a cloud of these craft that flew in, the exact phrase was a cloud of their mighty combat specter flew in and landed on top of the mountain. You make a claim like that. Well, then so-called modern historians, scholars, archaeologists scoff at that. They think, well, we know nobody flew before the Wright brothers. So this has to be mythology.
I don't think we're that closed-minded anymore.
Well, you and I are not. You and I are not. Trust me. You're in New York.
Here's another thing. Like to your point, when John, the Book of Revelations, when he reveals what's going to happen, he's limited to his language and his period.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also all kinds of indications that it seems there's a dichotomy between the development of language and expression, and apparently
There is that. However, Colin, listen. You take this information about the Tuatha De Danann and you point it out from the Labor Gabala Éireann, which is an ancient Irish text. Point it out to any professor at any of the universities in New York and say, what do you make of this? It's talking about they flew in. And I guarantee you 100%, I would be surprised if you don't get 100%. 100% of those professors are going to say, well, that's mythology. That's the way that group thinks. They brought us the flat earth. What do you think?
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you just can't make them understand that. You know, the microwave didn't exist. The Wright brothers weren't in the air, you know. And somehow we did that. And then 60 years later, we're breaking the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So,
you're right.
We have to understand that.
And most people do understand that. But it's the academia, it's the establishment PhDs. That's who decides that it's all mythology. That's what they say. Colin, I got to run, but I want to thank you for the call. Good points. We have time for another call, and if there is interest, we might go into after hours. If we do go into after hours, we will still close the show on time for our affiliate stations, and then we will just continue. At that point, you'll probably have to hear us at kevinsmithshow.com. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, this is Skye from Alabama.
Hello, Skye.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I was calling to say make a couple of comments. Danu was the Celtic goddess, a water goddess.
That's
she
not true.
She was also later known.
No.
Bridget.
No. 1,000 years before the Celts arrived, the children of Danu arrived. So if the Celts adopted the name Danu as the name of a goddess, that's a different goddess. But the Tuatha De Danu, or Danann, arrived 1,000 years before the Celts.
Yes, and she later became known as Brigid.
Well,
in the Celtic mythology.
Maybe, but I mean, they're adopting something that doesn't exist, okay? Because what did exist was 1,000 years before. And so if they use the name Danu, and if the Celts are calling it Danu, we have to understand that it was Da-Anu. And if they've misappropriated it, mistranslated it, applied it to a goddess, then that's something that they did on their own. But the name Da'anu comes from 1,000 years before they arrived.
Okay, and also we're talking about the Tuatha De Danann being having an aversion to iron.
Mm-hmm.
They were eventually left the island, and they became known after that as the fairy folk.
What the way the Labor Gabala Éireann explains it is that they had a real aversion to iron when people arrived who were very much Iron Age. The Tuatha De Danann retreated to the caves and were referred to as the fair folk in the ancient Irish. But in modern Irish, they have become the fairy folk. And, you know, here in America, when we think of the fairy folk, we think of the little Tinkerbell from Disney, and that's a fairy. No. The fairies, the fair folk, are tall, muscular, fair-skinned, blonde or red hair, blue or green eyes. And that's part of the lore in Ireland to today. They're not little people.
No, that's where I was going with it, is that, you know, they say, when you hear the modern-day thing about fairies with the wings, mm-hmm. a lot of times you'll hear that they can't be around metal. Well, if you're thinking about, you know, what fairy was, the fair folk, maybe it had something to do with, like, you know, we get heavy metal poisoning today, mm-hmm. working on, you know, men who work with steel and everything, and they know that, you know, it can be pretty damaging.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they were more sensitive to, like, metal and things than we are.
I think so. I think that would be, you know, if they had a purer DNA than us, then I think, yeah, that's probably the case. Yeah. But the thing about the...
Anu being one of the fathers of Enki and Enlil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then later came, you know, Inanna, which they changed their names on you. She's also known as Ishtar.
Yes.
Reading and understanding is that the Tower of Babel in the Bible was actually Inanna's.
Well, what happens, these so-called gods don't change their names. It's just different civilizations that have different languages, and so they use a different word to talk about the same god or goddess. It's just like I said earlier, I'm sitting in the United States, but someone in Mexico talking about that would not say United States. They would say Estados Unidos. And 1,000 years from now, people would say it had a different
name.
Hmm?
There's also, have you read the, there's a book called the Lost Book of Enki?
Yeah, yeah. And
it also refers to that in there, but there's so many, you know, a lot of times there's so many things on the internet you read, you get so bombarded with all this information.
That's true. We're running out of time. I'm going to ask you to hang on. We are going to go to after hours. But the way this works is I'm going to close down the show for our affiliates, just like always, and then I will come back on air after we close the show. If the affiliates wish to stay with us, they can do so. If your affiliate that you're listening to goes off, if we go off, go to kevinsmithshow.com and listen. Just click where it says listen, and you can hear after hours, okay? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.